And good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Mike Mulcahy. We're continuing our coverage of the fallout from the police shooting of Justine Ruscek. Coming up next hour at noon, Carrie Miller will host a live call-in program with Minneapolis officials and other experts. Stay tuned for that. But first, we're going to bring you a conversation with the Counter Stories team. It's about the shooting and its aftermath, and it's being experienced in communities of color. You probably know that Counter Stories is a regular segment on this program. It's a conversation by people of color, for people of color, and for everybody else. Today, you'll hear from Halee Lee, a media artist, Luz Marie Frias, an attorney with a public policy background, Don Eubanks, an assistant professor at Metropolitan State University, and NPR's Tom Weber. Anthony Galloway, another regular Counter Stories guest, was unavailable. We should note that this conversation was recorded before Friday's events, which saw Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges ask for and receive the resignation of Police Chief Janae Harto. Don Eubanks begins our conversation.
The dynamics of this shooting are extremely different than the dynamics of the shootings that we generally, unfortunately, have talked about often in Counter Stories, which generally involves a white male police officer shooting a young black male or another person of color. And in this incident, we have a reversal where the victim, the person who was killed, was a white Australian woman. And the officer involved, so far from what we've heard and what information has been released, was a black officer who happened to be Somali. And so the dynamics have changed. And boy, have we seen those different dynamics and how they're covered in the media. So what do we think?
When we first heard the news at home, the first conversation that we had was along the lines of how we would expect to see this unfold differently and true to form because of those dynamics and the reversal. And the analogy that I drew was very similar to at the height of the civil rights movement in 1965 when Viola Liuzu was shot and killed by Klansmen. Viola was a mother of five, if I remember correctly, who was an activist, white woman, middle class, in America, who saw the footage of the civil rights movement and African Americans being beaten by police and had the attack dogs on them, decided that she could not sit still anymore after she saw the first attempted march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. So she let her family know that she would join the march and go down and try to help in that setting. So, of course, we know that it took three tries to finally make it over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And it was after the third attempt that they were successful. And she, along with others, were giving rides to protesters from and marches from Montgomery, Alabama, which was the ultimate destination, back to Selma. And in one of those rides, she had a young African-American young man seated in the front seat with her, helping, bring people back and forth. And they were low on gas, so they stopped by a gas station. And as they were leaving the gas station, a car of four Klansmen pulled up next to them and were enraged that, A, she was helping these marchers, but also that she had a black man sitting next to her. So they shot her dead. And the spot, and her car careened off, the young man next to her was not harmed and survived. But the point of that is that killing in itself really sparked national and international outrage, much like what we're seeing right now with the killing and shooting of Justine, where not only has it sparked outrage locally by people who haven't necessarily been vocal on the killing and shooting of unarmed black men, but also internationally. And the point there is that too often when mainstream society, mostly white folks, don't see and feel the pain associated with the killing of black men or any other kind of person of color in unarmed police shootings, that level of empathy isn't there. But when they see themselves in that victim, much like who Justine was, a middle class white woman who was a model citizen, then that outrage begins. And we talked about this within our circle at home, thinking it's very unfortunate and it's tragic that her death occurred. But I also feel that it was not in vain, because many, many people, thousands of people then are waking up to that level of awareness about how it's really incumbent upon us and it's urgent to make those changes in police practices and policies.
I agree. I think a lot of times we're saying, well, people will not pay attention, right? People have woken up, not because it happened to a white woman. But I'm also afraid of what's going to happen with the immigrant cop. You know, is he going to be blamed because of his race? Is he going to be blamed because, you know, he's an immigrant? Is he going to be blamed for his religion? You know, it's a different dynamic in that sense, because I think people automatically, whenever anything tragic happens, people look to blame someone. And so I'm afraid that he's going to fall victim to that. However, this shooting, as well as the recent shooting in North Minneapolis where they shot two dogs, has gotten people paying attention, riled up, and hopefully that means that something will happen. They'll get the training they need or the vetting they need, and that we do have a systemic problem. It's not just black guys look scary, so we shoot them. It's happening to everyone.
Well, you know, you bring up the shooting of the two dogs, and
which there was a video of too, by the way. So
exactly.
A lot of people saw the video of the dogs.
Not body cam video, right, totally. But a camera video that captured it, because the body cam thing is a whole nother issue, mm-hmm. another dimension
the video
in this
was
discussion.
A homeowner's video, was
right?
It
was a homeowner's video, yeah. But, on the dogs.
You know what? I think my reaction. And, you know, because the dog shouldn't have been killed. The video does show the dog walking up.
Shot. They weren't
shot. Yeah, I don't think they were killed, Dave. No,
that's
they were
right.
Injured.
Shot. They yeah. were injured, but not killed. Sorry. But a dog, his tail was wagging. And usually when it's wagging, it's because, oh, gee, can I come
Friend.
With you? Yeah. But the outrage, the video received from members of the community, I think, and rightfully so, but it hurt me to my core, because young black men don't get that same consideration. And there's a friend of mine, his name is Andre Cohen.
So before we go in there, I was going to call that out, that I had a similar observation and stopped to kind of think about what is it about the shooting of the dogs and the shooting of Justine that could possibly differentiate or explain how this is being viewed. And I don't begin to put myself in the minds and heads of you know, the thousands or however many people who are interpreting this. But in my mind, one observation is that from what I've read in the officer-involved shootings and killings of black men and actually all men of color and women of color as well, is that they are blamed and criminalized for just being, right? So this person's a thug, so therefore they deserved it. And we know that within minutes of the shootings, often we see the rap sheet or allegations of the conduct that this person may have had that's completely irrelevant and not known at the time of the shooting, but a way to justify that they are less than valuable or less than human or less than important in life. And that's where I see that in a person's mind who is not yet fully woke, as Anthony often tells us, sees that as, well, these dogs don't have any blame and there's no criminalization of them. Justine, we didn't, you know, criminalize her. And so in both settings, they're like these pure type of scenarios of without blame, without judgment, without
anything. Whereas Philandro, he shouldn't. Not reach for his gun, which he wasn't.
Exactly.
You know, so there's always somebody
to blame.
Or the
smell of weed or whatever.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
These and other extenuating.
Yeah, I think the smell of weed would probably be more of a, well, to your point, because the whether he's reaching for the gun remains, will always be disputed only because there was no body camera video.
Right.
But to your point, the smell of weed, for example, would be a factor. Whereas
but
if the dogs smell like weed,
but
I don't know.
After announcing to the police officer, even if he was reaching for the gun, he still wasn't doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. Therefore, so even that argument and scenario doesn't hold water. But
no, I know. I understand. I was simply saying that because that gets into what Luz was saying.
You know, and this is, so to address what Luz was saying, in social work, we have a word we use when we work with clients and we work with others. And because in social work, we are generally concerned about the people we work with. And the one thing that we do is we show those individuals empathy as we try to empower their lives and help them turn their lives around and help them help themselves. What is missing in the scenario when we discuss shootings that involve people of color is that lack of empathy. And as I mentioned, I've taught, I teach a class called Comparative Racial Analysis in at Metro. And, you know, we can talk day in and day out. And I think one of the major issues that, for me, I feel is present in a lot of these situations is the bias that
absolutely.
That
but
the officer
to your
brings.
Point about the lack of empathy
and
desensitizing folks because of whatever reason, that's why it's Black Lives Matter.
Right.
I mean, that's the point of this all, right? Is that somehow their lives don't matter enough to be empathetic towards or to really understand and look at the systemic changes that are needed in the police and law enforcement practices.
And I think Black Lives Matter has come out with some statements and stuff about the situation and
Justine Diamond.
The Justine situation. And so it's like, now do people understand what they do, what they're aiming to do to talk about, you know, violence in the police community, and so maybe we needed that to bring people together.
Well, and the Minnesota Women's March before noon on Sunday, so less than 12 hours after the shooting occurred, there was an email from the Women's March partnering with NAACP of Minneapolis organizing the vigil that did take place that evening. So we are seeing, again, more of that collaborative organizing across interest groups, that the intersectionality is there.
Yes, unfortunately, it is happening to so many communities now, right? Because there's a few months back, it happened to an old Hmong lady who was in her shed in her backyard, and the cops came and pointed a gun at her and scared the hell out of her. You know, and the Hmong community and Black Lives Matter really came together on that. Mm-hmm. And so now we're seeing it happen over and over and over to different communities. Is this what we needed to have this discussion? And is this discussion ever going to actually be held where it matters, where the people, the lawmakers, the people who make the rules, the people who do the training, where they actually have the conversation and change things?
Don Samuels, the former Minneapolis city council member who's on the school board now, wrote on Facebook, to your point originally, actually, Don, another Don here, quote, this is again from Don Samuels, "It might be risky to say this, but I'm grateful this was not a Black victim, white cop scenario. I'm glad the victim did not have a record and was not poor, so the race and class issues can be set aside as factors that might trigger complicating and ancient anxieties."
Uh-huh. And while I agree with that statement, unfortunately, race is still going to play as an issue in this as it moves forward.
Because of the police officer.
Because of the police officer.
Is he Somali?
The fact that the Minneapolis Police Federation has not come out and made any statement in support of this particular police officer speaks loudly. Mm-hmm. And we cannot sidestep the fact they came out right after Jamar Clark's shooting, right after Philando Castile's shooting. They, even though it wasn't a mini, they have supported every other police officer involved in a shooting, but I have been woefully silent, much like the NRA. Mm-hmm. But is NRA that, had to do with the Philando Castile.
But is that because of the race of the officer, or is it because of the situation?
We don't know, but what's really interesting is WCCO did a 10-year review of the footage of every single officer-involved shooting in Minneapolis for the last 10 years. And in each and every one of those, within, you know, a short period of time, hours, the police union was holding a press conference or being vocal or issuing statements about how justified, even in the dog case, mm-hmm. how the shooting of the dogs was justified, right? So you have 10 years of consistency of footage of the police union coming out, but here it's radio silence.
And the police union also gives unions a bad name. So I don't want people to think like unions are horrible, because I do believe that the police union and the way that they behave gives all unions a bad name.
But not only that, the fact that the information on the shooting has been trickling out so slowly.
Yeah.
I actually was going down to Morton, Minnesota early Sunday morning to play golf and then stay. I had a little package, 2 days of golf.
You're
whatever.
Always playing golf.
Yeah, anyways. So anyways, when early that morning I was listening to news and they talked about that there was a woman shot by police in South Minneapolis. And the fact that the woman wasn't identified immediately told me she was white. So
why?
Because in Minnesota, if it's a person of color, we are told that.
Yeah.
If it doesn't involve a person of color, it's okay. Just a woman.
The police shot a black man, or police shot
exactly.
I understand.
So anyways, the fact that even during those first 8 or 9 hours that they didn't immediately come out to support that officer, because they knew who had shot who by that time. Mm-hmm. They knew that. Mm-hmm. But they still didn't come out before any of that information was being released. That speaks volumes. And because even in this situation, after the other officer said that they were slowly driving down the alley with no lights on, all of a sudden they hear a loud noise, bang, and it's been described as different types of noises. One could imagine that she probably slapped the side of the car to get them to stop. Something mm-hmm. as simple as that. Or, mm-hmm. but we don't know.
All yeah, I think there's speculation about aerial fireworks being a potential.
Just a loud noise, and then she appears at the door and gets shot by the partner across his partner, right? And now there's stuff leaking out saying that he actually had his gun out on his lap. I don't know if that's true or not, but these reports are... To me, that talks about the culture, the whole police culture, mm-hmm. that they're at a point in their training, or whatever, that it's a shoot first, and then you kind of ask questions later, and not even that, it's just...
The other big part of that is, before the use of smartphones to record video, right, there was this carte blanche understanding and culture in our communities across the country that, at least mainstream communities, that when police made a statement about what happened, it was unchallenged. People just accepted it. Mm-hmm. There was no ambiguity or doubt to that. It was truth, absolute truth. But when, at the advent of these recordings then being... You know, what I say, you know, democratized, where everyone has a camcorder by way of their phone available, and the footage then being shown, that become at least questionable. And then we have the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago a year or so ago, and it came up this year in terms of charges, where Laquan was shot 16 times. The officers then go into the nearby Burger King that had the footage of the shooting to erase the footage that was proprietary in the Burger King. Little did they know that there was a camera above them filming them trying to erase it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, you have enough of these proof points that we're seeing that now society is becoming more comfortable with challenging the veracity of the statements made by police officers as to whether or not they're, in fact, telling the truth.
It would be really interesting to see not only what the union is saying, not only what BCA is saying, the mayor, but also just what the media in general, how this is being covered compared to, like, when Philandro was shot. Yes. It would be really interesting, like, 6 months from now to go back and review all
and
that.
And collect it all. I'm already reading articles written by one media outlet that starts their headline, Killer Cop.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, yeah. Oh. They just start their article with Killer Cop. To get back to your point,
Don, is that when Philando was shot or when Jamar Clark was shot, that would not have been that story
Giannis
started.
Giannis was not portrayed as a killer cop, right? And so most of the stories were trickling out in terms of either Philando's character or Diamond's character.
Right.
But can I try to finish what I was trying to say very quickly? To support what Luz was saying is that on Facebook, someone, because of a smartphone, recorded a bar full of police officers at a karaoke bar singing to the song Bad, Bad Leroy Brown, and they changed the lyrics, and they were singing about Michael Brown. It was horrendous.
Oh, I have not seen that.
Oh, yes.
But, Lee, you were trying to...
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, the folks who have been very adamant about Blue Lives Matter, right? There are some folks who have just been... they're the cops, and they risk their lives, so they should be able to do whatever. Do they still feel the same now?
I don't know. It's a great question, because I know in social media that I There are things that cannot be unseen. So when I start seeing these comments that are just charged with racist remarks, I have to turn away. I just can't expose myself to those. And I've seen just horrific comments about Officer Noor, you know, the officer who did shoot and kill Justine, and how he doesn't deserve to live, and very pejorative statements about his identity as a Muslim, his identity as a Somali officer, and then also speaking to friends who are Somali and saying that they're now in this heightened awareness for more hate crimes committed or statements or acts committed against them, because that's the other unfortunate but very real consequence of being a person of color, is that you are in this group dynamic, that you're guilt by
is associated across the entire group.
My concern with this whole thing is I don't feel comfortable calling the cops anymore. You know, my husband and I just called the cops a few weeks ago because we built a new patio in the front of our house. And so we sit outside, and this couple comes running up. We live across the street from a park, and this couple comes up to us and they call the cops. Can you guys call the cops? And we're like, what happened? There's like, there's a guy chasing us with part of a fence post, you know? And so we called the cops, and this guy had we had a confrontation with this guy, you know, and he eventually ran off back into the woods, and it seemed he was unstable as it was. And so we called the cops. The cops showed up like 10 minutes later, and we had to wave him down because he drove by past us. And so I'm thinking, like, maybe that's just what Justine did. She tries to wave them down. She tried to get their attention, hey, I'm the one that called you.
Exactly.
That could have been us, you know?
Exactly.
And we were four people, but...
You know, it's really interesting that you ask that question, will people be comfortable calling the police, and you yourself saying that you're not. So two comments on that. I have a colleague who is passionate about race equity, and she's a white woman, and she said to me just yesterday, I don't feel safe calling police.
But that, and
I thought that was really interesting, though. But this is this is the consequence of where we're at in terms of fear. Mm-hmm. The second part of that is now hopefully a realization that people of color, particularly African Americans, live in that fear 24/7, and how overwhelming that is, but also how much trauma that causes a psyche for years and years, not just for short periods of time.
No, your entire life.
I was driving back from one of these big warehouse stores this weekend in suburbia America, and on a Sunday evening, because that's what we do, by myself. And as I was trying to get on this major road, which is on an expressway, there was just this backlog, and I just thought, well, that's kind of goofy, right? I'm going to take my other route. And so I proceed to do that, and as I do that, I see that there's just like 8 squad cars and a bunch of cars. And you come to the conclusion it's a car accident. It's a pretty bad car accident. And one of them looked like some person was pinned in the car, and they had to extricate her from the car. So I, in that process of doing that, there's a blue van, older van, driven on the side next to me, and police is just like almost in hot pursuit of that van. But you come to find out that the officer looked like he was doing that simply to get this van to move so that he can cut through the two of us and go to the other site. So this van and I finally reach this stoplight on this road. He motions me to roll down my window, you know, on the passenger side. He's to the right of me. And he says to me, gosh, that was bad. You know, that's a heck of an accident. I said, yeah, you know, it looked really bad. He says, 7 cars. And I said, yeah. I said, I hope everyone's safe. And then he says, I just want to be safe. I just need to be home safe with my family. He says this 3 times in the span of 10 seconds. He's an African-American man in his, like, 40s. And it just was a powerful exchange for me because, you know, we already had seen the headlines with Justine being killed. And that fear that he had, what it appeared to be because of this officer, this squad car pursuing him just to kind of get him to move over. He didn't know. I mean, he wasn't, you know, in the fear and the anxiety of the moment, wasn't understanding why. For the remainder of that evening into the next day, that moment kept replaying in my mind and thinking that is that palpable fear that is just overwhelming for folks that I hope people begin to understand drives what we need to do differently.
Yesterday, I was driving down Dale Avenue in between Maryland and Larpenteur. And there's that stretch there. They have a sign that says 30 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's I've been on that
and
stretch.
Most people do.
How many tickets have you gotten on that time?
Most people do 40.
Yeah.
But I think I was doing like 32 miles an hour because I'm getting older. So I'm just
You're not in a rush to go play that golf, right?
I'm just cruising down Dale, and I look in my rearview mirror, and here comes a black St. Paul Police SUV. I mean, and he comes flying behind me. And now I'm bricks, right? He comes flying up.
Lights on?
Right, no. Which is what made it even worse.
Right, yeah.
All right.
When you know it's a cop car,
exactly.
But they don't
and
have the lights on.
He comes flying up behind me, and I'm looking at my speedometer. I'm doing 32 miles an hour. I'm getting ready to get pulled over for doing 2 miles over the limit. He rides behind me for about 30, 40 feet, but I must have been going too slow because then he pulled around me, and then he no sirens. I don't think he was responding to anything. And then he speeds off doing at least 40 miles an hour.
So how did you feel in that moment?
For that minute, my life was, I thought, oh, my God. you know, and he was just impatient. But as a person of color, as a male of color, I was scared to death for that short amount of time until he pulled around me and then sped off. Yeah. But when I saw him coming up in my rearview mirror, it was like, oh, sorry. But unfortunately, that's what the kind of pressure we live
and
under.
Thing, I want people to understand that, right? And I'm thinking this will help them to understand that. Because at some point, you know, I was like, well, I'm a young Asian woman. How threatening am I to a cop? But apparently... anybody can be shot, right? Yes. So I'm hoping that's what people realize in their minds is that, oh, I'm a middle-class white woman. I can be shot. And then maybe we can get something done.
You know, the to your question, Hilly, about do I feel safe even calling for emergency anymore, we've heard those comments since Justine was shot. And one of the interviews I did... with the city council member there said, we have to call the cops because there's this fundamental civics 101 philosophical, this is how institutions around public safety works. The infrastructure of what we think about as public safety relies on people calling when they see something wrong. And so I hear that, right? And then you think, okay, I get it, right? The whole structure comes tumbling down if we don't call the cops. I get that point. But if communities of color, long before Justine was shot, already weren't calling the cops.
Nothing's changed for us.
How high was that infrastructure? How much had that infrastructure already crumbled, I guess, is my question. You know what I'm saying?
How deep had it penetrated and permeated that level of distrust that people wouldn't call.
And I don't know the answer.
It's a really interesting question. And that question, though, is premised on the fundamental knowledge or expectation that law enforcement will continue to exist the way it always has existed, you know, as a system. And there are alternative forms of policing and ideas for that have taken ground and made progress, not only in the U.S., particularly in California, but also in other parts of the world. And coincidentally, I've been involved with some conversations around some of those studies in my previous role. And I am still involved with that group and talking about bringing some of those conversations here locally. And it was in response to the Jamar Clark shooting. Now, if we should step back some from where we're at right now in terms of our system of policing. Had we listened and paid attention to the clarion call of any one of these shootings, whether it was Jamar Clark or anybody before that, Michael Brown or Eric Garner or whomever, we ask ourselves, would have Philando Castile been shot? Would Justine have been shot? Had we listened as a society and paid attention at those times, would we have a different system or accountability now to have prevented those deaths?
And do any alternative ideas and models, I would presume, maybe I'm wrong, but I presume that whatever the alternative is, whatever those ideas are still predicated on the idea that the input comes from us, that if we see something wrong, we still make the call.
So one of the models is a model that would entail a partnership between community leaders and the city, because there still needs to have that infrastructure, right, of reporting. And rather than deploying law enforcement officers to certain calls, that community leaders then would be deployed to resolve. It's basically an alternative form of, you know, kind of dispute resolution.
Conflict resolution, dispute resolution.
I don't like that. You need to hear more about it and where and what the elements of it are. But there are models that are working in various cities around the country, particularly, again, in California. There are also models, of course, in terms of co-policing, where you have someone who is trained in mental health issues with the officer in the same car to go towards de-escalation tactics. And really going into de-escalation, we know and we're told by police unions as well as the post board that the de-escalation training is a big part of it already. And we know that the city of Minneapolis in particular is one of six cities in this national initiative on building trust for community that was nationally, you know, recognized and came after Ferguson. And they were trained in de-escalation. So that part of it hasn't been challenged yet. And I'm waiting for that in the news. It's like, wait a minute. Here's one of six cities where a deeper investment of resources and training has taken place. Mm-hmm. And yet we find ourselves where we find ourselves.
And there was no body cam footage.
Exactly. So the challenge there is then the type of training that is being deployed, is that the best training?
Right. I mean, people talk about that a lot, like, you know, the training, but the training's useless if people don't follow it, right? So I have the body cam because I'm supposed to, but if I don't turn it on, it's useless.
Well, there was, we had a council member who spoke to that earlier this week on NPR that said, you know, a $60,000 investment, right, to equip those cameras so that they automatically turn on. I mean, that's a very small price to pay, and it's a heck of a corner to cut and not having that. Mm-hmm.
I think we've touched on many different topics involving this tragic shooting that happened in Minneapolis this weekend. And a friend of mine, Andre Cohen, posted on Facebook today, and I asked if I could use his quote here. But I think what he wrote talks about, I think, some of the different aspects of the shooting that we just briefly discussed. And in his question, he wrote, which is the stronger push, the protection of police or the prosecution of a black man? Or is it the protection of whiteness or the villainy of Muslims? And I think that to the next time we come back, we might have an answer to that. I'm Don Eubanks, and this is Counter Stories.
The Counter Stories team is media artist Halee Lee, attorney Luz Maria Frias, Metropolitan State Assistant Professor Don Eubanks, and, of course, NPR's Tom Weber. Again, a note, this conversation was recorded before Friday's events, which saw Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges ask for and receive the resignation of Police Chief Janae Harto. Earlier today on Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer talked with the president of the union that represents Minneapolis police officers about the new chief and about body cam policy. You can find that interview at mprnews.org. He also explained why it took so long for the union to comment on this case.